This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Please call us at 877-217-5757. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Alondra Villarreal is producing. Do want to make a program note. Yesterday, we finished the show with Mark Ballard talking about Trina Edwards, the widow of Edwin Washington Edwards, the governor who died 3 months ago. Well, Trina will be with us Monday. That's the plan. And she will talk about not only her life with Edwin Edwards, but also the latest development. The former governor has been exhumed and cremated and now rests on her mantle in Ascension Parish. So it should be an interesting conversation. And this should be interesting, too. We've got Jennifer Richardson, lifelong Baton Rouge resident, loves this city and is trying to do something to make it better. And her passion is cleaning up litter. And among all the other issues we have, and we do have a few, we have a litter problem. There's no doubt about it. And it's worse than it is in other places. It's not good. But she's doing her best to make it better. And she and her group will be out tomorrow morning. They've been doing this for 8.5 months now. It's called Keep Tiger Town Beautiful. And good morning to you, Jennifer.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, how did this all start?
Well, really, it was kind of a dare. I had been, you know, looking at our city for years and years, and I'm watching it getting worse and worse and worse. And I just couldn't stand it any longer. And I hated listening to myself complain about it. And I was telling a friend about it. And she said, well, you are not a joiner. You don't do anything. You know, why don't you do something? And I said, okay, I'm going to do it. So I posted on Facebook. Yeah. I posted on the Nextdoor. And I thought, well, whoever comes, you know, I was praying that somebody would come. And so I was so excited. I couldn't sleep the night before. And the first place we cleaned up was Jefferson at Essen. Mm-hmm. And there were weeds growing 5 feet tall all around that median right there in front of the country club in that red light where people just, you know, throw their cigarette butts out. And then the panhandlers love that little spot. And so it's just plastic styrofoam.
Baton Rouge Country Club?
Baton Rouge Country Club, right in front of the Baton Rouge Country
Club. I bet they like that.
And every time I drive up there, I'd go, blood pressure is boiling. I just want to get out and weed. I want to pick up all that stuff. It's just making me crazy. So the first time I said, let's meet there at 7 o'clock in the morning so we don't get killed. You know, the cars are going to be whizzing by and everything. So I got there probably about 6:30 and I started cleaning up and I kept looking for people and nobody was coming. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be here by myself looking like a total crazy woman. But, you know, at this point, I don't even care. I had already weeded half the neutral ground. So I look over and people are coming in out of the bushes with their tools. And
they're helping.
Yeah.
So you got lots of volunteers.
I got awesome volunteers. And people would stop in their cars and wave and honk and say, what are you doing? And I'd say, we're cleaning up the city. And they'd say, great. And one guy stopped and he said, lady, what are you doing? And I said, I'm cleaning. And he goes, do you need help? You have mama tools. I had my little garden tools. He said, I'll be back in 5 minutes. He bought a power blower, weeder.
So now you got high powered stuff.
Well,
right?
Not always. Cause I, you know, some people don't come back, but the core people are there every single Saturday.
And all right. Well, this Saturday, Jennifer Richardson, who is, I guess for better terms, she is the president of Keep
Tiger Town Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
She and her crew will be at Sherwood and I-12. Mm-hmm. You're setting up at the Raisin Canes, is that correct?
Yes, that's where we're going to be parking.
Right. And you'll probably have several hundred of your closest friends there if things go according to plan. All of whom are listening to this show right now. I'm sure everybody who comes to listen to this program today. But that area is... it's one that needs a little sprucing up too, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, there is a lot of panhandling going on over there. So they leave all their stuff. There's lots of homeless people there. They leave everybody, you know, with big hearts want to give these people plastic and give these people canned goods and give them, and they just leave everything. And
it's
drug
not just
needle,
panhandlers, though.
No, it's not just panhandlers. I mean, it's getting worse. And it's just really bad. Most people driving down the road don't see what we see. Mm-hmm. You know, we see beyond what's in the road.
We don't show respect for each other, and it's amazing, these people with dogs, and I love dogs, but if your dog makes a mess in my yard, you should clean it up, but usually people don't.
It's a lack of respect,
and yes. I bet these people don't have respect in other ways. They probably can't bench press their weight.
No. I mean, it's really, I always say, well, people go, well, they're homeless people. I go, yes, but you can respect people's property. You don't have to, you know, leave your litter everywhere and hypodermic needles and, you know, just the stuff we have to pick up. If people were with us, they would go, oh, I see what you mean.
I'm assuming you use gloves.
Yes, we use gloves and grabbers and rubber boots. And we're like an army. We're going in. I mean, we're like ready to, you know.
Now, is it mostly women or is it men? Is it a combination?
Well, you know, it's changing. At first, it was mostly women over 60. You know, that it just, they were like ready to tackle it. And now we're getting more and more men involved. Some of the women bring their husbands. And then once you do it, you are addicted to it because you can never see trash anymore on the side of the road or anywhere. Before, you know, we were born in Baton Rouge and we raised our kids in Baton Rouge. So it's like living next to a train track. You know, you don't hear it anymore. You don't hear the train coming anymore. Well, there's so much litter. I think people have become blind to it. But all I have to do is give them a trash grabber and get them out there for 1 minute, and they are addicted. I'm telling you.
Back in the 70s, I remember there was a nationwide push to combat litter. What happened to that?
Well, they quit those ads. That was the Crying Indian. One of them was the Crying Indian, which is my ultra favorite one. He really wasn't an Indian. Mm-hmm. He was an Italian man from Ville Platte, Louisiana. Did you know that?
I did not know.
Yes.
That.
And so anyway, but people had took.
I know he died a few years ago. Yeah. But I didn't know he was from Ville Platte.
He was from Ville Platte, Louisiana. And anyway, I run that on my Keep Tigertown Beautiful Facebook page. So if y'all are listening, please join Keep Tigertown Beautiful. You can see the before and after pictures of every single cleanup we've ever done. And some of them are hysterically funny.
And you're doing this mostly on Facebook, right?
Yeah, Facebook and the Nextdoor app.
Okay. 8 o'clock tomorrow, Sherwood and I-12.
Right.
You'll meet at the Raising Cane's, and you go for what, about an hour?
We go for an hour, and, you know, sometimes we have little scragglers coming in, those that are OCD. Some of them pick up trash on the way home. They can't stand it.
Yeah, well, she's a dynamic lady. She's lived her whole life here, has children and grandchildren, so you want to make Baton Rouge beautiful, and we do need to do a better job of that.
Yes.
And it's any particular area you've given me two locations that are in South Baton Rouge. Where else do you go?
Well, right now we are doing South Baton Rouge because that's where we live. And what I want to tell people is wherever you live, okay, start your own group. Because if I live in South Baton Rouge and I never go to North Baton Rouge, I don't know what's going on over there. But you know what's going on over there. So form your own group. And get your people together. It's addictive. It's fun. You will meet the most interesting people, and the finest people in Baton Rouge come to my litter pickups. I tell people that all the time. These people are like, they're just the bomb, you know.
So. Well, this is a dynamic lady, and you have what I would call the Baton Rouge accent. I can tell you're from.
Why, thank you.
You're from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And went to Lee High School, right?
Yes.
Now Liberty High. Have you changed your diploma yet?
No, and I am not going to change my diploma. No. Lee High is, that's our school, and, you know, I know all the songs and the fight songs and all that. We can't change that with Lee to Liberty.
Great athletes went to Lee High, including Dan Clater, the former state senator, who was on a football team with Leonard Smith and Albert Richardson.
Right.
Played in the NFL. I think there was another big one on that team, but they were pretty strong, I hear, back in the day. And Lynn Whitfield, the actress.
That's right.
High school,
she did. And I went to school with her brother and Rob and Dan. I know the Claters, and we grew up together.
Well, I'm glad you're doing good work in your hometown and have this passion for it. And this is an area where we can do it. I mean, when we talk about fighting crime, we can't stop a bullet, but we can pick up litter.
I say that all the time. You know, we can't do anything about the crime, but we can clean up the city so that people will respect our city. One of the things that I've done is I've cleaned Lee Drive, that bridge that was full of garbage the other day, and I'm thinking, and Holland Road, and I'm thinking, this is where the public is coming, thousands and thousands of people to the LSU games, mm-hmm. and our streets look like Calcutta, right? And
I'm like, I haven't been to Calcutta.
Well, look it up. Do a little research.
I know about Calcutta. Right. I know where it is. Well, I just haven't been there.
Yeah.
But it's
horrible.
All right.
You know?
Well, thanks for what you're doing, Jennifer Richardson. Keep Tiger Town beautiful. We'll look for an update soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We turn the page and we're joined for a segment by a remarkable person in the nation's capital, Kristen Henning. Dr. Henning spent more than two decades defending black children prosecuted for offenses like horseplay on the metro, throwing snowballs at a passing police car, and playing catch with a teacher's hat. She's seen kids as young as 9 and 10 handcuffed, counseled countless teens living in persistent anxiety that they will be stopped, searched, and interrogated as they take a walk with friends or go for a bike ride. She's opines that we live in a society uniquely afraid of black children. Dr. Henning is a member of the Georgetown Law Faculty, has been for 20 years, and is director of Georgetown's Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative. And she is the author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. 877-217-5757. Nice to talk with you, Professor Henning.
Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate your having me on your show today.
This is a issue in our world and in our country that I don't have personal knowledge of, obviously, but you say, and I think many now agree with you based on what we have witnessed, that this is a problem in Washington and Baton Rouge, all over the United States.
Absolutely. And I love your opening sentence is that you don't have the personal knowledge. And I think so many of us don't recognize the pervasive criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors among black children. And so I'm hoping that my book will bring greater awareness to this question. And I should say, indeed, I draw from many stories about young black youth in the nation's capital, but throughout the book, I also weave in stories about black children all across the country who have been criminalized for doing what teenagers do, what white teenagers do everywhere, not just in the United States, but everywhere across the world. But yet, we don't show them the grace, the tolerance, the forgiveness, the support that we show to white children. And even in the book, there are stories about mm-hmm. the use of canine dogs. You talk about Baton Rouge, the use of canine dogs on children, on black children. And it's really important for us to become more aware of this critical issue.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org to join Dr. Kristen Henning, who's with Georgetown University, director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at that great university. And you're talking about how black kids have it different than others, and I think we would acknowledge that is true. But is it worse based on your knowledge in certain parts of the country, maybe in this part, in the South, than it is elsewhere, or is this a universal trend?
Oh, such a great question. And I want to say the answer is it's a universal trend, and that we often find ourselves wanting to relegate the criminalization or the dehumanization of black children to the South. And I was born and raised in the South, and certainly the South has a deep history of difficult race relations, to say the least. But we are sorely mistaken if we try to relegate this to one geographic area. And throughout the book, I give examples from New York, California, really throughout the country. And really, our nation has a long history of dehumanizing Black children. From, as we know, from the era of slavery, when Black children were seen and treated as the property of of plantations. But even from then, we moved to the civil rights era, in which a young child like Emmett Till could be killed, really symbolically, to make a symbolic statement that our nation will not tolerate the integration of Black children into white schools. But then it moved forward. And the only ways in which we can justify those types of brutality is to paint Black children as dangerous, as a threat. And so Emmett Till was painted as a threat to white women. And the real important point is that those narratives then become deeply embedded in our American psyche.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Kristen Henning. We'll take a few calls with her. The Rage of Innocence is her book, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. Jim in University Hills. Jim, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi. Yesterday, the local news reported an incident in Covington where a student, and it happened to be a Black student, beat up a teacher. It was all caught on phone video, a teacher who was in a wheelchair. And I'm just trying to figure out where we draw the line between whether we criminalize a behavior. One of the people on the news report said, well, a lot of these kids don't know where to draw the line with what's appropriate. I think that's
all right. Thank you, Jim. Your response, Dr. Henning, to this news report in Louisiana involving an alleged assault on a teacher by a Black youth. Obviously, go ahead. You answer the question.
Yes. First, let me just say how incredibly tragic that is, and how horrendous that is for the teacher. And so the question becomes, where do you draw the line? I think the line drawing question is how do we provide young people with the support and programs, resources, education that and social emotional learning, conflict resolution, mental health services that will produce a young person who can be safe and engaged in the community. And so I think it's really important to differentiate the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors from the holding a young person accountable for their aggression. But we can avoid aggression by providing young people with the support and care and that they need in the community.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on with Dr. Henning. Good morning, Carol.
Hey, I just thought about something. When you mentioned that you didn't have firsthand knowledge, you just need to go to a high school football game and watch how the inner city schools are kept under wraps, and the private schools like Kappa Chi, the kids run wild.
All right. Well, When I said I don't have firsthand knowledge, I'm obviously not a person of color. I'm in the majority race. That's what I meant. But I think all of us have some knowledge, and some of us have firsthand knowledge of disparities between how Black kids and white kids are treated. And that's basically your point, is that when you start at a disadvantage, and when you're treated differently, that is a disadvantage. Sometimes it makes it hard to catch up, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that goes to the prior question, is that we have aggression and we have violence in schools precisely because we don't that young children of color are often at a disadvantage, and we need to provide them with the same access to resources. And I really appreciate the last comment as well about the disparities in the ways in which students at private schools all across the country are given the freedoms of adolescents to play and the like at a football game, but that at a public school, very often the the schools are absolutely on lockdown in terms of surveillance and the like. And I think it's a you make a fair comment. I think we as a community, we loosely understand that there are racial disparities, but we don't really understand, as you said, you know, if we're not living in a community of color, the depths of the trauma, to be quite frank, that young people suffer as a result of those racial disparities.
Dr. Kristen Henning, her book is The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. We live in a society uniquely afraid of black children, she says. We only have a few seconds, but Dr. Henning, Georgetown, as we know, was sued for selling slaves, the university you're employed by, and I wish we had more time, but I'm sure you're fully aware of that, and it is a stain on a great university, isn't it?
But there is an effort afoot, you know, for reconciliation. And I think what has to happen with that conversation about, you know, schools owning slaves.
We thank you very much. And we're back after this. This is Jim Easter. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we go to another topic and an important one. Emily Jackson is in the house. She joined the Companion Animal Alliance team as philanthropy director in June of 2018, has transitioned to communications and grants director. And this is an organization doing its best to help animals in our community. And we love our animals, and we've got lots of them. We got some of them that are, of course, running unabated. And Emily, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about the Companion Animal Alliance.
Sure. So we are the East Baton Rouge Parish Open Intake Shelter, which means that we accept all animals. We don't turn a single one away, whether that's a cat, dog, chicken, horse, pig, rabbit. We partner with animal control as well as public drop-offs.
So when you say you partner with animal control, do you have to euthanize some of these animals?
We are an open intake, yeah. So unfortunately, there are animals that arrive at the shelter that are not suitable for adoption. That could be because of their health. That could be because they are showing signs of aggression. So we take that into consideration before rehoming them.
But we have a lot of animals who are, of course, uncared for. And maybe the demand is such that of those in need that we don't have enough people to take care of them. What do we do at that point?
Yeah, that's the great challenge. We have found solutions to finding more and more homes. In fact, recently we've picked up transports with national partners, sending our dogs as far as Canada to places where they have a shortage of pets, unlike Louisiana.
Yeah, my friend Mark Calvert told me that, you know, they do like relays here. They drive like
right.
50 miles or so, and then the next person
That's
gets
right.
it, and then it goes. That's an amazing process.
It is, yes, and it's saving hundreds and hundreds of animal lives.
The group is the Companion Animal Alliance, but you have an $8 million shelter. And I hear you, not only cats and dogs, you've got pigs in there, right? Horses?
Horses,
you got all kinds
donkeys.
Of
yeah, we have one donkey right now, lizards, snakes, we take it all.
So it's a major undertaking, and I suspect you obviously need community support, but are most people aware of what you do, and are people getting their cats and dogs taken care of, spayed and neutered, and making sure that they're not out there populating the parish without the proper care for their offspring?
Yeah, I would say outreach and education about our organization is something that we are prioritizing. Since the move from where we used to be, closer to the Baton Rouge Airport, now we're over on Gurrier Avenue near LSU's campus, we have found that there are a lot of people that are just finding out about us and what it is that we do and what we stand for and what our mission is. And we hope that we can continue spreading the word, mm-hmm. like you said, about spay-neuter, about adopting. The one thing that we have found repeatedly in terms of education is the difference between an open intake shelter and a rescue. So Baton Rouge, a lot of people are familiar with Friends of the Animals, Cat Haven, and those would be considered your rescues. Our shelter is an open intake municipal shelter.
877-217-5757 for Emily Jackson, who is from Mandeville, went to LSU and stayed, and has family here, right?
Yes.
And I bet you have some animals too.
I sure do. Two shelter dogs.
Did you get them from this endeavor?
Sure did.
Now, a listener asked at talkatalklouisiana.org about how in the old days, and maybe it's still the case, when these cats and dogs are picked up off the streets, they were taken out by the airport. Is that still the case?
They are brought to us at our new location,
so
off Gurrier Avenue. That's
they
right.
Go to you.
They all come to us.
So if somebody picks up one of my cats, if they get out of the house,
yep.
That's where I would go look for them, right?
That's correct.
And you know, once I found a cat there, right there in the amid all the other animals, and there was my cat, and you know, we were happy to see each other. It was a very pleasant reunion, but that was at the old place, and that was an amazing spectacle. There were hundreds of animals in there. It's sad, though.
It is. It's sad. I mean, I can tell you today we have 285 dogs, 365 cats. That doesn't include the donkey, the chickens, the guinea pigs. So at any given point, every day, we're caring for over 650 lost and abandoned animals.
So how long do they stay there?
It varies. I mean, we hope that the length of stay is no longer than 30 days. Ideally, it's shorter than that. The longer, I mean, you can imagine, the longer that the animal stays in a shelter environment, the worse that they typically are in terms of their mental health, and even their physical health can decline.
Emily Jackson of the Companion Animal Alliance is with us, and let's go to Trish in Grand Coteau. Trish, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you. Hi, Trish. Emily, excuse me.
To say something about dog rescue in general. Is that when you rescue a dog, when you get a dog from a shelter, you think you are rescuing them. But really, the dog is rescuing us. There is no more joy greater in the world than getting an abandoned animal and see them blossom to life and their personality come out and them relax and actually getting to enjoy the life they should have had all along.
So. All right. Trish says it helps the person who's doing the rescuing more so than it does the animal, but I think it's a team thing.
Yeah, we know for certain that the pets that are given a second chance are extremely grateful, and they show you that in lots of ways.
877-217-5757 for Emily Jackson, who is a mover and shaker with one of the really important organizations in our community, the Companion Animal Alliance, and her official title, Communications and Grants Director. Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on the air with Emily. Good morning.
Hey, Emily. I just wanted to state that like the last two puppies I adopted, I actually saw one of their pictures on the website. So like people can go to the website and look at the different dogs and cats. And I actually saw a picture of a dog that kind of caught my heart in St. Francisville. And I went there and I not only adopted her, but adopted the sister because the sister was so friendly. And I still have them to this day. You know, I have them a little over a year now. And so I went to the website and that's how I adopted my last two dogs.
All right. Patrick, being the good humanitarian that he is, has adopted some animals and I'm sure they're very appreciative and it's made Patrick's life better. Probably controlled some of that anxiety that comes out on his call sometimes. So we love that. Animals help us, don't they? It's been proved that animals reduce blood pressure.
Absolutely. And we were pushing pretty hard during COVID that if you were at home, if you were laid off, that this was a good companion. We knew that it could improve your health.
And the great thing about it is that this is a nonpartisan issue. People can be animal lovers and they can be Republicans, Democrats, whatever.
Then
it's non-religious, nonpartisan. And a society, Hubert Humphrey, the great graduate of LSU, said a society is largely governed or judged by how it treats people at the beginning of life and the end of life. But I think a society also is judged by how it treats animals.
That's correct. I've heard that before, and we believe that.
Well, you are the, as I mentioned, Communications and Grants Director. You got an $8 million facility, but the beat goes on there. You have to have sustenance. How do you keep the trains rolling at the Companion Animal Alliance?
Yeah, I mean, the only way that we can is with the support of this community, and it's in a variety of ways. Volunteering. We've got folks that walk our dogs every day. They're socializing with our cats. We have a network of fosters that temporarily take our pets into their home, which opens a kennel space for us in the shelter for the constantly arriving new animals. And donations. And whether that's supplies, you drop off your old newspaper for us, or paper towels, and monetary donations as well.
All right, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to get in under the wire with Emily Jackson of the Companion Animal Alliance. There is a website. The listener asked about that. Is that?
CAABR.org.
CAABR.org. And another listener asked about the laws in Louisiana for spaying and neutering animals. Do we have the proper laws on the books?
There are ordinances that our shelter follows, but there's no requirements, at least in East Baton Rouge Parish, requiring spay-neuter.
Really?
Correct.
Well, that's not good, is it?
That is, in our opinion, as the open intake shelter, no, that is not great.
Well, would that be a Metro Council thing?
It sure is, yeah. And our board of directors are very supportive of our mission and our priorities with spay-neuter, and that is something that has come across the desk quite a few times.
Well, I would think that might be something to address, but the numbers you gave were a bit concerning. What give us those numbers again. How many dogs and cats do you have there right now?
Okay, let me see if I can repeat that. 285 dogs, 365 cats. Yeah, so on any given day, it's 650 plus pets. And on an annual basis, we're looking at minimum 8,000 animals arriving at our door. Up to 9,000. And this year, we think it could hit closer to 10,000.
10,000. And what do you look for? Do you basically let you give people a shot when they want to adopt, or do you kind of do a little bit of research?
We are open adoption. So we work with you to make sure that the pet that you're looking at is actually a good fit for your family. But we hardly turn away an adopter.
Well, that's good to hear. And, people of all kinds love their animals. And what about people, another listener says, when they want to come in, they want to adopt 10 animals. Do you allow them?
Sure.
Please, take 10. You take all 10.
Please.
You can take all 285.
That's right. Take the whole litter.
So I see this photo of you. Is that a photo with your dog?
That is Old Man Moose. Yes, I adopted him from the old shelter back in 2012, I believe. Yep.
Still with us?
Still with us. He's kicking.
Beautiful animal.
He's a real cute poodle mix.
Well, you're doing good work. And
thank you.
For many people, animals are as important or maybe even more important than close relatives. And it is a process that is an important part of life and says a lot about our community. And in this realm, I think we're ahead of the curve. So thank you. Thank you, Emily.
And thank
you. Keep up the good work. Let's talk again soon. Emily Jackson of the Companion Animal Alliance, CAABR.org. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us, and we're pleased to round out the week with one of the top historians in our country, Dr. Kyle Harper. He's professor of classics and letters and the provost emeritus at the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Harper is noted far and wide for being an historian on the ancient world. His work has spanned economic, environmental, and social history. And in 2017, after several other books that are, of course, staples as far as historical context, including The Fate of Rome, Dr. Harper decided to write a book about pandemics. That was in 2017. That was before we knew about coronavirus and COVID-19. His work is Plagues Upon the Earth. It's a monumental history of humans, our germs, weaving together a grand narrative of global history with insights from cutting-edge genetics. Kyle Harper explains why humanity's uniquely dangerous disease pool is rooted deep in our evolutionary past and why its growth is accelerated by technological progress. And good morning to you, Dr. Kyle Harper.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I'm an Okie, but I wanted to say my wife's a gal from Louisiana and my in-laws live there. So I make it down to your neck of the woods quite a bit and love it down there.
Well, and both universities that are the major universities in our communities are pretty good football programs, too, at least in most years. And LSU beat Oklahoma 63-28 on the way to its national championship a few years ago. Oklahoma.
It's been great being with you today. Thank you. that was a bad day. That was my 40th birthday, and you ruined it. So,
were you in Atlanta that day? I was there.
I was.
Yeah.
It was not a good day.
Yeah, but Jalen Hurts is doing pretty well, and Oklahoma football is right near the top, although you survived a close game with Tulane. But we only have a limited time, and we're talking about plagues upon the earth, and this is a book that reviewers call Panoramic in Scope, tracing the role of disease in the transition to farming, the spread of cities, the advance of transportation. As we have more humans, we're more susceptible to diseases. And Dr. Harper, I think you've come to the conclusion that we're more susceptible to pandemics.
Right. It's such a deeply rooted part of our past and such a constant pattern of human history. And as you said, I started the book in 2017 and was intending it to be a warning that another pandemic was inevitable. Of course, I was about halfway done with the book when that prophecy came to fruition. So I had to really put a little more urgency into getting it done. But it's, I think, important to try and understand how we got here and what are the patterns of history and what can we learn from them? And one of them is simply that as we grow, as we multiply, as we expand and use more energy and use more of the environment, we're more exposed to infectious diseases. And so in many ways, we have the greatest set of tools we've ever had in our history to control them with vaccines and pharmaceuticals. But we also are more exposed and more endangered than we've ever been. And so we live at the kind of intersection of greater tools to control disease and greater fear, the threat of infectious disease. And COVID-19 was the one that got through.
It got through, but is this the dress rehearsal? Could we end up being in future peril, perhaps even more extreme than the current one?
Well, I think so. And I think it's why it's so important that we learn what we did well and what we have to do better to be more prepared. There will be another pandemic. We don't know if it'll be more destabilizing or less. I think we can recognize that COVID-19 is really insidious in some ways. It's very, very contagious and very good at spreading in the kind of societies we have. But the bad news is that it actually could be more severe. It's a very dangerous disease, as we all know. But it could be worse. There are much more virulent diseases. The other coronaviruses that infect humans that cause diseases like SARS-1 and MERS are actually much more deadly. And probably the only mercy of this disease is that it doesn't cause severe disease in children and young people. But there's no reason why the next one couldn't be worse.
Now, you have studied this over time, and back in the day, centuries ago, we didn't have nearly as many people, but we had plagues, and that's the book, Plagues Upon the Earth, and you say that plagues have affected humanity from many, many moons ago, including the Roman Empire. Tell us more.
Well, the Romans are my specialty. I fell in love with history in college, and particularly Roman history, and ended up going to graduate school and specializing. So I really am more of a specialist in Roman history. And that's how I got into this, because the Roman Empire suffered a really dramatic series of pandemics. And they're very well attested in the ancient historical sources. But in the second century, there was a plague that we call the Antonine Plague that may have been an ancestral form of smallpox. We still don't completely know. And it really hit the Roman Empire at its height. And the Roman Empire was never as strong again, ever. Of course, it did recover and continue to be powerful. But in the later centuries, another plague came. We call this the Plague of Justinian. And now we know with absolute certainty that it was the bubonic plague. So it's the same disease that caused the more famous Black Death in the late Middle Ages. It was probably the worst pandemic in human history. And we know now that it also struck the later Roman Empire and seems to have killed a huge number of people. The sources are very dramatic in describing the death tolls that really would, you know, COVID-19 pales in comparison to some of these historic plagues. And certainly this devastating death toll had a had an impact on the fate of the Roman Empire. So that's the chapter of history that I kind of know best. And studying those pandemics made me want to step back and say, why do these happen? Why do human societies have infectious diseases? And how do they respond differently to the challenge of disease?
Kyle Harper is with us, one of the top historians in the country, and he is only 41 years old. Many books to come, but this one is an epic tale of plagues that have affected us from the beginning of time, plagues upon the earth. One reviewer, the Pulitzer Prize winner Elizabeth Finn, says it illuminates the inexorable toll of infectious disease on humankind over thousands of years. The net effect is a clarion cry beseeching us to forswear denial and hubris for realism and collaboration when it comes to vulnerability to disease. What can we do? What can we do to thwart this as we move along as humans?
Well, I think we had gotten complacent. And even though we were warned that this would happen, I think we just didn't really take seriously the risks of infectious disease. And I want to underscore that we really were warned by the experts in public health and infectious disease. I was at a workshop in Santa Fe, New Mexico in May of 2019 and having dinner with a virologist. And I said, as a historian, you know, I really worried that we would have another pandemic and something like influenza, which I still think is very dangerous. And he said to me, yeah, but in this May of 2019, he said, yeah, but keep your eyes on coronaviruses. There's something about them. They adapt to humans and seem to just pose a threat that we need to take more seriously. So this didn't come out of the blue. People warned us that we needed to be more prepared. If I were in the big picture as a historian writing the history of COVID-19, mm-hmm. I would give our scientific response an A++. The vaccines and the things we've learned about treating and managing COVID are really impressive. And that'll help us going forward.
James in Metairie. James, you're on with Dr. Harper. Hi, James.
Hi, Jim. Good morning. Professor Harper, you know, as OU fans know, that this is OU Texas weekend, and many Sooner fans would believe that Texas football is a plague upon the earth. Boom, a Sooner.
There you go.
Well, I would just say that's a fact.
That's a fact. yeah,
that's
well.
A fact.
Texas isn't what it usually is, but it should be a good game and great rivalry. That's one where I mentioned earlier in a segment about animals bring us together. Sometimes athletics can as well, so that's a good thing, even amid a pandemic. But another listener, Hal in Monroe, asks, how in your estimation, as an authority on these things, how did this pandemic begin? What was the origin?
Well, I think it's very important to be open-minded about that and not to be prejudiced either way, and not to think that it couldn't have originated in a lab or originated from wild animals. And I don't have all the facts, and so I like to be humble. I'll tell you that I'd be willing to believe whatever the facts lead us to find. Most of the infectious disease experts that I follow and respect think it's most likely that it has a natural origin. And I'll tell you, as somebody who studies the history of infectious disease, that would not be surprising at all. Most of our infectious diseases come from wild animals. And so I suspect that a natural origin in bats is very likely. I wouldn't rule out either that it's a perfectly natural virus that was in the Wuhan lab and then escaped without being scientifically modified. But even that isn't necessary. Humans are in contact with wild animals all the time, and we get their diseases. And like, as I was saying earlier, the people who really understand this have recognized that coronaviruses posed.
We do have to roll, but it's an important book, Plagues Upon the Earth, from Dr. Kyle Harper. Hopefully we'll visit again soon. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Stay safe and stay tuned.